Actually, the title's even shorter than that. It's just soil omics, because I'm going to be discussing a little bit more than just proteomics. I could think of this invitation as either a considerable challenge or a great opportunity. This is the first time I've ever been asked to speak about soil proteomics, and as you'll see, it's a very new field, but we are making some headway in this area, so I'll consider it a great opportunity to come and discuss this today. So some of the research that we're doing is focused on the impact of climate change. So Rachel described one of our projects, which is dealing with permafrost. Another region that we're looking at is the Great Plains of the United States. And this is a very important region as well when it comes to impact of climate change, because predictions are that as there is a change in climate, this is going to alter the precipitation. And we might hear more about this in the, I'm looking at Sarah, you might talk about that also later, maybe. So this means that there are going to be longer, more frequent storm events, probably differences in precipitation frequency, some areas that will have increased drought, and some that will have more flooding. So how is this going to impact the soil carbon? As we saw from Rachel's talk, there is a lot of carbon that is stored in soil, and how will these changes impact the carbon that is stored there? And ultimately, that's going to be due to the microbial functions in the soil. So the main question that we're looking at in this research is, what is the impact of climate change, for example, altered rainfall patterns and land management strategies on soil microbial communities and processes? So if we look at the prairie soil land area in the United States, you can see in green, this is the prairie land, and also the amount of organic carbon that is contained in the soil in the prairies. So there is a significant amount of carbon that is stored in prairie. So it's been estimated that prairie soils account for 27% of the continental U.S. land surface and 31 to 39% of the soil organic carbon stock. So I mentioned that with climate change, there's supposed to be a shift in the precipitation. So with a lower emission scenario, the more brownish shaded regions predict areas that are going to have increasing drought, and the more blue are states that are going to be experiencing more increased rainfall. So even with the lower emission scenario, we can see that there are going to be, especially in the southern states, more drought, and in the northern states, more precipitation. So this leads me to one of the very grand project that's being carried out by the Joint Genome Institute. It's a pilot project for the JGI Soil Metagenome Initiative. It's called the Great Prairie, and this is coordinated by myself and Jim Teagy from Michigan State University, together with many scientists at the Joint Genome Institute and other collaborators. So I think in this audience, I probably don't need the next couple of slides, but I'll include them just to hit the point home that we all know that soil is particularly challenging compared to other environments, not only because we have this vertical heterogeneity as you go through the different soil profiles, and also you can have site-to-site heterogeneity that can vary from the centimeter scale to a kilometer scale. When you look at the microheterogeneity, even within a small granule, you can have considerable heterogeneity with air, water-filled pore spaces. You have patchiness of organic matter, and those are the regions that that's where the microbes want to be, of course. They want to get access to that organic matter, but it may not always be accessible because of the pore structure. In addition, we have humic acids that can complicate things, especially when you're trying to extract macromolecules from soil. And then the clay particles, the soil particles themselves, have charge, and you have a hydrophobic interaction of molecules to the clay particles, the soil particles, and the roots. So if we're thinking about, I mean, we're discussing proteins eventually, but you're trying to deal with separation of charged hydrophobic molecules from this very complex matrix. Another thing that we've heard several times already is the aspect of diversity. So this is the image of the universe. So this is a satellite image. So 10 to the 11th stars in our galaxy. But if I instead put an image from the microscope, it looks quite similar. So we're looking at this huge amount of cells. And in one ton of soil, we have 10 to the 16th microorganisms. And there's 10 to the 11th stars in our galaxy. So we're talking about a huge amount of different types of cells, huge diversity, large number of cells. And most of them, we have no idea what they do or who they are because we haven't been able to cultivate them. So to bypass the need for cultivation, a lot of us are using just omics tools, which is a toolbox of molecular approaches where you just extract molecules from the system without relying on cultivation of the organisms in order to understand who's there and who's functioning. Now, the type of omics method that you use, this is what I call an omics pipeline. There are different kinds of tools that we can use, starting with understanding who's there, looking at the microbiome. And this is looking at the microbial community composition based, for example, on 16S genes. The metagenome then includes the entire complement of genes, including the functional genes. The metatranscriptome would be then the RNA, which would give you information about what genes are expressed. The metaproteome, which proteins are produced. And finally, the metabolome, the metabolites that are produced by the community. So this results in the need for a multi-omics approach. So starting from your soil sample, either extracting RNA, DNA, PCR amplifying genes, sequencing, or going directly and looking at the proteins in your sample. So back to this grand challenge soil pilot study at JGI. These are the sampling sites that we've chosen to study the Great Prairie. So we're looking at three different states, Wisconsin, Iowa, and Kansas. At Wisconsin, we have a native prairie, and then we're comparing at each of these sites to a long-term cultivated site, corn in all three cases. In Wisconsin, we also have a switchgrass rotation, which was previously corn, and we also have a restored prairie. And you can see this makes a nice transect across the prairie states. These are our three sampling locations. Now, I'll start to just give you a little bit of an update on where we are on the microbiome and metagenome data analysis so far before going into the metaproteome. So for each of these sites, we chose plots and had a sampling strategy that was designed by the statistician to enable us to look at the heterogeneity across the plot. And so we looked at a quadrant and at a 90-degree angle from a reference core at different spatial distances, 1 centimeter, 1 meter, and 10 meters away from the reference in two different directions. And so each of these were soil cores, 1 inch in diameter, 4 inches deep. In total, we have then, if you look at all of the sites, we have 8 reference cores, and these are the ones we use to do the metagenome sequencing, together with the 64 spatially separated cores from each of the plots, and that we used for the 16S sequencing. So just to reiterate the methods, so we have the soil cores, extracted the DNA, determined the community composition using the titanium pyrotech sequencing platform, and we used both of these second-generation sequencing platforms to get the soil metagenome, both the titanium, 454 titanium, and Illumina shotgun sequencing. So, questions. First thing, and this was already discussed a little bit in Cheryl's talk, so are samples separated by small distances similar, or is each site its own story? And so this is addressing the issue of within-plot versus between-plot variation. Well, to make a lot of data on one slide, we can see that these are the three different sampling locations. And what we saw was that at each treatment at each site clustered together. So that would suggest that there is a similarity within a specific site. And that is enough to cluster together so that you have a treatment effect here. So the cultivated corn samples from each site separated from the native prairie samples from each site. And these are all of the other treatments from Wisconsin, including the restored prairie, which was previously corn, and the switchgrass, which was previously corn. So they kind of all look like corn here. And this is the native prairie. And if we take all three sampling locations across this transect in the U.S. and put all the data together, in blue we have all of the native prairie samples still separated away from all of the other treatments. So it almost looks like there's some sort of a native prairie microbiome that is distinct for prairie compared to cultivated soil. So the conclusion from this pyrotech study would be that the samples from an individual plot cluster together, and that the native prairie soil microbiome is distinct from the cultivated soil microbiome in each state. So we conclude that cultivation has a major impact on the native prairie microbiome, and I just said this. So the next question is, which members of the community differ? And for those of you who don't know, this is Jim Teagy standing by his own corn field. So this is looking then at the different phyla that we saw and comparing across the sites. And one thing that we see that there are some dominant microbes that we find in all of the different sites. So for example, proteobacteria, acidobacteria, actinobacteria were dominant in all of the different sites. But then we have some things like Verruca microbia that are more prevalent in some of the sites than others. And when you look at this at a more fine level of resolution, I don't have that slide here, but you can find specific species that are really more prevalent in some samples than others. Now, to give you an update on the metagenome sequencing, and this slide's a little old, so we actually have more metagenome data than this currently. So we have at least, well, the Wisconsin, these two Wisconsin samples are still being run. But if you look at the 454 sequencing, this is in megabases, and the Illumina sequencing is in gigabases. We've got a lot of sequence data. And we've recently run, I think all of these have been run now, on the HiSeq. And the HiSeq is like the next generation of Illumina sequencer, which gives you almost 200 gigabases per run. And so we're definitely not lacking data for these samples. We have a data deluge, I think you would say, or a data bonanza, I'm supposed to say. We have a data bonanza, a lot of data. But you can use this data and start to explore, based on the metagenome data, start to explore differences in function, looking for functional genes that are differentially more prevalent or less prevalent in the different sites. And so, for example, in Iowa, this one side of the plot is just showing specific gene functions that you find in the prairie, and the yellow is corn, and the same for Kansas. So we start to see some functions that indicate that there is a difference, some functional genes that are different in this data. But we're just starting to look at that that data. So even at a metagenome level, you can start to see something. So what this study is still ongoing, so we haven't really explored it that much yet. But the soil microbiome is more similar within plots and between plots. Soil management has an impact on the soil microbiome. And so what we want to do next is to study the functions and pathways and to really explore this Illumina data. This point was made by Eric and a couple of others too already today. We need to have more reference genomes. A lot of the data has no matches to any database, so we need more reference soil genomes. For example, Acidobacteria and Verruca microbia we found to be very highly represented, but there are very few, if any, reference genomes for those groups. So to back to this first question, what is the impact of altered rainfall patterns on the Great Prairie soil microbiome? We have a new DOE BER project that's coordinated by our chair of this session, Dave Myrals at Oregon State University, that is going to specifically look at that. And this is a field study on the Kanza Prairie that is is called the RAMPS, Rainfall Manipulation Plots, but where they have done rainfall manipulations over a long period of time, and then we'll get samples from that. And the nice thing about this is that this is one of the sites where we actually have metagenome data already. So we have the Kanza Prairie metagenome data on hand, and then we're going to look, use that as a scaffold to look at this these rainfall patterns. Okay, now what I'm supposed to be talking about today. The metaproteome. Okay, so metagenomics versus metaproteomics. Okay, why do we even want to know about the proteome if we can do genomics? Well, metagenomics gives us information about gene content that has the potential of being expressed. However, those genes could be coming from dormant or dead cells. If we look at proteomics, metaproteomics, we have evidence that gene expression under a given condition, those genes must have been transcribed and translated to produce a protein. And in my opinion, that's better for assessment of microbial function. There have been some recent advances in soil proteomics, and I've cited a few of these references, two from 2007 and one from 2009. So in the first study, the proteins were extracted from soil using a direct lysis method with sodium hydroxide and phenol. And some proteins were identified. They're not very many, but this was using a SDS page gel, but still showing it's possible to extract proteins from soil. The next study also was looking at specific types of proteins, and there they used a blocking with bovine serum albumin and Triton X100 to try to block the hydrophobic sites in the soil, and were able to successfully extract a single known enzyme. So this was a targeted approach. In the 2009 study, this was an improvement on the soil extraction method. This, again, more of a targeted type approach, looking for glomalin-related soil proteins, and they relied on the sequential extraction with citrate, phenol, and detergent, and were able to identify these proteins on gels. So this is the method that has been most commonly used so far, which is quite useful, especially if you're doing a targeted type approach where you can identify a spot on a gel and sequence it. And the method that I'll be talking about today is a different kind of approach where it's more like a shotgun proteomics approach, similar to shotgun metagenomics, where you take your sample, you lyse all the cells, and then you run them through a mass spec, and you have potential to identify thousands of proteins. So this method was worked not for soil, but for another system we look at, and this is human gut, and this has been in collaboration with Nathan Verberkmos and Robert Hedick at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory, where we, and the human gut is, although it's much simpler than soil, it's still complex. So we have thousands of different species represented, and at the time that we did this, this was the most complex sample to try the shotgun metaproteomics approach. So we used a differential centrifugation to extract the cells from the sample, lysed all the cells, and did a trypsin digestion. The peptides were separated by 2DLC mass spec, and then they were also further separated and cleaned on a column before using this electrospray that we heard Richard talk about. This is a mass spec that uses this electrospray, very high mass accuracy. And here's where we need our metagenome data, because the only way you're going to identify any peptide is if you can match it to something when you're doing a database search. And so we were relying on reference gut microbes that have been sequenced for a database search, but for soil, we need to have soil metagenomes and soil genomes. And then you can identify proteins and predict their function. For the gut, if we looked at average metagenomes compared to average proteomes, we found that if you look at the metagenomes, you get a fairly equal representation of categories of gene function compared to the metaproteome, where you have enriched or skewed distribution, more proteins for translation, energy production, and carbohydrate metabolism, which makes sense because these are processes that should be occurring in our intestines as the microbes in that environment are breaking down our food. So, soil. I already mentioned the microscale heterogeneity in soil. So we have the particles, etc. So we wanted to compare direct and indirect protein extraction methods and then try the shotgun approach. And we do have a manuscript in press that describes this method that I'll be describing. So the first thing we needed to do was to develop a method for extraction of proteins from soil, then develop a method for lysis of the cells. We tested these protocols using a known soil microbe as an internal standard. So we inoculated non-sterile soil with a microorganism that we know quite a bit about. This is an Arthrobacter strain that we've been working with in my group. It's nice to have as an internal standard because it's gram-positive, very hard to lyse. And we inoculated it into a California grassland soil, which was non-sterile. So we still had the background microbial flora there, and compared to soil with no inoculum. This Arthrobacter chlorophenolicus, it can grow on chlorophenol, and this is the gene cluster for that process and the degradation pathway. So we added chlorophenol to the soil as a specific substrate to enhance our chances of being able to get proteins from that organism. Another nice thing is that the genome has been sequenced at JGI, and we have the proteome already for the pure culture of this organism grown under different pure culture conditions. So we've already identified about 3,700 proteins for this bacterium, and we know the protein coding genes from the genome. And this just shows a heat map showing examples, if you hone in on the proteome, looking at different growth conditions, that you can find some proteins that are differentially expressed. And I won't go into detail, but this is from the pure culture proteome. So back to the method development. So here's our Arthrobacter. We chromosomally tagged the Arthrobacter with a GFP marker gene so that we could differentiate it from natural Arthrobacter that might still be in the soil. We added it at two different cell concentrations, quite high, because again we wanted to optimize our chances of seeing something, either 10 to the 9th or 10 to the 8th cells per gram in non-sterile soil that had 4-chlorophenol added, and we compared to a soil with no inoculum, and this is the California grassland soil. So we extracted the soil proteins, we also obtained cell counts, and we extracted soil DNA and did quantitative PCR of the GFP gene to be able to monitor that microorganism specifically. So initially, we tested all the different kinds of cell lysis methods that had been demonstrated for soil, so sonication, sodium hydroxide extraction, bead beading, and direct guanidine denaturation. Got a few proteins that in some of these, but you know, less than a handful. So we decided to start over again from scratch. So we tried two different methods, an indirect extraction method and a direct extraction method. And this is an old slide I had. It used to have DNA here. I just changed it to protein. I feel like a little bit of deja vu because this is the same thing we were doing for DNA many, many years ago, comparing indirect extraction methods and direct extraction methods. The principle, the difference behind these two techniques is that with an indirect method, you're first trying to separate the bacterial cells away from the soil particles before cell lysis, whereas a direct extraction, you directly extract the proteins. So the indirect method we used, we started with 20 grams of soil, blended in a buffer, a phosphate buffer, everything in the cold to prevent the proteome from changing. Did a rapid low-speed centrifugation to pellet the soil and debris. Then we collected the supernatant and did a high-speed centrifugation to collect the bacterial pellet. And then lysed the cells. We had two different lysis methods. Guanidine lysis is the standard lysis method that is used for mass spec analysis. And we also tested a new method, SDS-TCA. So here you can see the SDS-TCA method that was used, and together with the direct protein extraction method. So again, starting with soil, added to SDS and buffer, boiled for 20 minutes, pelleted the debris by centrifugation. A supernatant was collected and added to chilled PCA, an overnight precipitation of the proteins. They were collected by centrifugation, washed with acetone, and then solubilized in guanidine with DTT. This was incubated just to help the proteins to solubilize. Digested with trypsin, denatured and desalted, and run on, separated then on the 2DLC mass spec. So these are the results of the looking at the types of proteins that were found, and these are going to be primarily arthrobacter proteins. So looking at the indirect extraction method, we find that both the guanidine lysis and the SDS lysis, we don't really have major differences. We have a good distribution across different functional categories of proteins. We have, I should probably mention, we did get several hundred proteins from each of these methods, almost 1,000 proteins, but no real big difference between these two lysis methods. So in the absence of the soil matrix, both lysis methods were equally effective. So if you first separate the cells by differential centrifugation, you could lyse by either SDS, TCA, or guanidine. Both seemed to work equally well. That was not the case for the direct extraction method. There, definitely the SDS lysis method resulted in a higher recovery of proteins than doing a direct guanidine lysis in soil. So SDS lysis was more effective when directly extracting proteins from soil. Now, if we compare the indirect versus the direct lysis method using the SDS approach, we still get a better representation using a direct lysis, but it's not really that different. Both methods resulted in a similar protein distribution, but there were generally more protein identifications with a direct lysis. So if we look at the proteome yield from soil, this is looking at just one row of a very long table. So we can calculate the cell biomass. We had 20 grams of soil. We inoculated with 10 to the 9th cells per gram. At the end of our incubation, we had a 24-hour incubation. We had 1.4 times 10 to the 9th cells that were counted as CFU. The GFP copy number was a little bit higher, 6.4 times 10 to the 9th copies. We could have multiple copies of the chromosome as it's replicating. The extraction method in this case was the indirect and lysis with guanidine and 732 peptides. So in these 732 peptides, we found two GFP peptides. That's 0.01 to 0.06 of the relative spectral counts. So this is in good accord with representation of GFP in the predicted Arthrobacter proteome, which is around that level. So it's one copy in about, you have almost 4,500 predicted genes. So it's a pretty good accord with what you'd expect. And it's important to keep in mind that the absolute concentration of proteins is dependent on several factors, including protein stability, turnover, expression levels, et cetera. So now this is the really interesting stuff. So this is all looking mainly at our internal standard, but we have the natural soil proteome as well. So in the Hopland, California soil, we have over 700 proteins that were identified. This is the deepest soil proteome coverage to date by far. In that, we had 165 bacterial genera that were represented, so a huge diversity of genera. And at the species level, of course, it's much higher than that. Based on searches, and again, we're only basing this on searches to deposited bacterial reference genomes. There are thousands of proteins, but these are the ones we could identify. So some examples, what do we find? Okay, some of the most represented genera and proteins, we found a lot of Bacillus spore proteins. Okay, so this is a California grassland, and it hasn't been treated. We didn't add any substrate, and so these bacteria are pretty much existing in a subsidence level, a lot of spore-forming bacteria. These two that are in bold were the most highly represented with respect to the proteome. We saw a lot of bradyrhizobium proteins, a lot of chaperonins, sugar transporters, and nitrogen regulation genes. For some reason, we found a lot of these facultative intracellular parasites, showing up. No idea why, but they were there. A lot of Burkholderia, and there were phases. These are interesting too. Granule-associated proteins that accumulate to high levels in strains that are producing PHA. So those were how they represented. And again, chaperonins. Chaperonins was the most common category of proteins overall. Chaperonins. Nitrobacter species, chaperonins, translation factors, and the most abundant was this Rhodopseudomonas palustris. So most of the proteins were representative of this microbe. Ribosomal protein, chaperonins, signal transduction, nitrogen regulation. So apparently in that soil, this organism plays a large functional role in Streptomyces species. And that's just a little taste of what was there. So just to summarize, both of these methods, both indirect and direct proteome extraction methods, were successful at identifying hundreds of proteins in soil. I think that, you know, one caveat, if you're thinking about the indirect method, since it is a differential extraction, not all the cells will be extracted. You're going to lose some compared to doing a direct extraction. And also with the indirect method, you may have bias against secreted or extracellular proteins using that approach. But otherwise, I think that they're both good methods to use. And we did find a wide range of protein types and bacterial genera represented, but this is still the tip of the iceberg. So we have to find some way of getting deeper into the proteome. So just to conclude, so back to understanding altered grain impacts on carbon sizing processes, this new project is starting up. Now we have the tools. We already have this data, the microbiome and the metagenome. So together with our collaborators, Dave Myrold is going to be focusing on the RNA. Together with Oak Ridge, we'll be looking at the proteome. And also we're going to try to look at the soil metabolites as well. And just to mention that in our group, we have, in addition to the soil project, we have other kinds of metagenome projects ongoing, including looking at the recent Deepwater Horizon oil spill. So we have a lot of data from that system and some twins metagenomes. In fact, the day before yesterday, I was talking about this project in Miami. So. And this has already been mentioned, but one thing that hasn't been mentioned about TerraGenome is that this is an open consortium. Anybody who is interested in joining is welcome to join. You just need to sign up on the website. It's kind of interesting considering it's not funded, how it's really growing. The community is really growing. There are getting to be more and more associated projects within the TerraGenome consortium. So it's free to join, whoever is interested. And I'd like to conclude with acknowledging my collaborators in my own group, my new project coordinator, Dave Myrold, and his group at Oregon State. Kansas State University is also involved in this new DOE project. Jim Teagy and his collaborators for the Great Prairie Study, the Joint Genome Institute, Eddie Rubin, Susanna Trinch, and Rachel McElprang. Rachel's helping also with the Great Prairie Assembly. And the Oak Ridge National Laboratory for their help with the proteomics funding from DOE. And I'd like to acknowledge my Berkeley group, my current group, and my former Swedish group. Thank you very much. Yes? Dave? Yeah, depending on the method, that was the majority. We're in the, like here, well, they're at least one of the major groups that you can't.
Is that a question of harping the database? There's still information there for example, certain motifs or things that you can find for that you can not put into these data.
Yeah, here I think it's since we were blasting against Arthrobacter and everything else, but it's really the gene annotation wasn't completely, you know, represent, it wasn't finished for that genome or for any genome. So there's still a lot that we don't know, even in the reference genomes. There's a lot of unknowns there. Elder? Our cell recovery was very high because it was only a 24-hour incubation. So for the differential centrifugation, what we did was we looked at the amount of cells that we had in that cell pellet and we plated it out, and we had very high recovery. So I don't worry so much about recovering something that we just add and we extract. I worry more about, you know, maybe for some of your studies where you have a real long incubation and the microbes might be in small micropores, or that we would miss those. But here we had a very high recovery. Yes? Seasonal variation? We didn't look at that yet. We're just now, with the proteome data, we're just thankful we can get proteins out of soil, so we haven't really done anything more than that. So this is just developing the method, but that would be really interesting to look at. Yes, so for these samples, we sifted and tried to pick out the roots. So, yeah, just to keep it as simple as possible. Yes? We're also very interested in that. We have that carbon data, but we're going to go and we're actually going to send in assays to get the amount of black carbon in those samples. But we don't have that data yet.
Well, thanks again.